Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I'm Chris Anderson. Today, we're taking on something pretty significant. A really comprehensive look at the Associated Press for Monday, August 11th, 2025.
And I'm Lee Bradley. My job here is to help you connect the dots, maybe uncover some of the deeper implications, and, you know, really get a handle on what matters most in these stories. Our goal, like always, is to sift through this mountain of articles, pull out those key bits of knowledge, and turn the daily news into, well, a shortcut to being properly informed.
Exactly. Think of it like your own personalized briefing. We're aiming for those aha moments, you know? Without all the noise, we've got a really packed agenda today. Everything from global conflicts, shifting politics, to health insights, and honestly, some pretty weird stuff, too. So as we get ready to unpack all this, what's jumping out at you?
You know, what always strikes me is just the sheer range of human experience you see in a single day's news. You've got the terrible consequences of war and disasters right next to these subtle shifts in public opinion or these quiet efforts to keep culture alive. It's all there. And we'll dig into not just what happened, but why it matters for you. The aim is you leave with real insight, not just a list of facts.
Okay, let's dive in then. We're starting with global flashpoints in geopolitics. First up, the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is defending a new military offensive in Gaza. He's calling it, quote, the best way to end the war and the best way to end it speedily. But Lee, the AP report suggests this offensive is actually, well, quite a bit wider than first announced.
That's a really critical point, Chris, and it immediately flags concerns. The core info tells us the targets aren't just Hamas strongholds in Gaza City. No, this push goes into what they're calling central camps and Mawasi. And these are areas sheltering over 500,000 displaced people. 500,000. Netanyahu did claim safe zones would exist, but he also admitted right away that these zones have been bombed before. That contradiction. It's a massive red flag for the humanitarian side of things.
And we're definitely seeing the condemnation ramp up, both inside Israel and internationally. There are reports of relatives of Israeli hostages actually calling for a strike, not by the military, but a general strike against the government taking over Gaza City. That really shows the deep splits within Israel itself about how to handle this incredibly difficult situation.
Absolutely. That internal pressure is a huge factor. And then you have the international reaction, which has been, well, fast and pretty varied. The UN Security Council had an emergency meeting. The U.S. defended Israel's right to security, called genocide claims false, and used its veto. Big move. But then you have China criticizing collective punishment, Russia warning against reckless intensification. So you see this really clear, complex picture of the global politics at play and maybe growing isolation for Israel on this specific issue.
And setting aside the diplomacy for a second, the humanitarian crisis, it's just horrifying. Ramesh Rajasekhem from the UN Humanitarian Office, he put it very bluntly, quote, this is no longer a looming hunger crisis. This is starvation. He even added, humanitarian conditions are beyond horrific. We have frankly run out of words to describe it, which is just stark, especially when you put it against Netanyahu's claim that there is no hunger, there was a shortage, and there was certainly no policy of starvation. What does that huge gap tell us between the UN's assessment and Netanyahu's denial?
Yeah, that disconnect is incredibly worrying. It really points to a crisis of information, maybe even trust. When a top UN official uses a word like starvation, it's based on, you know, actual assessments, data from people on the ground, Netanyahu's denial. Well, it suggests either he's profoundly unaware of the reality or it's a deliberate attempt to manage the narrative, you know, for political reasons. For the rest of the world, this makes it so hard to coordinate aid effectively or even grasp the scale of the emergency. And it deepens the frustration for nations pushing for a ceasefire and access because it feels like basic facts are being disputed.
The reports on aid distribution are just harrowing, too. AP details 31 Palestinian deaths near Israeli-controlled corridors, Marag, Netzarim, Tiana. Witnesses accused Israeli forces of firing into crowds trying to get aid. And there were incidents near these GHF sites, that's the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, meant as an alternative to UN aid. Though GHF denies incidents happened at their sites, it just shows the incredible danger people face just trying to survive.
And the human cost keeps rising. And not just from combat. The statistic that really stands out, 100 children and at least 117 adults have died from malnutrition-related causes. Depending on the report, that's since the war began, or just since June. That's a staggering number. It speaks directly to the impact of blockades, lack of aid, destroyed infrastructure. People are literally starving.
And there's also this deeply concerning report about journalists being killed. Al Jazeera correspondent Anas Al-Sharif, three other journalists, and a driver were killed in an Israeli airstrike. Now, the Israeli military claimed al-Sharif posed as a journalist and was with Hamas. But al-Sharif had denied political affiliations before, and the Committee to Protect Journalists had actually expressed concern for his safety, citing a targeted Israeli military smear campaign.
So what does this whole situation around al-Sharif tell us about the sort of information war happening alongside the shooting war? That's a really key question. These conflicting stories around his death, they're like a small snapshot of the bigger information battle. When a military says a journalist posed as one or had affiliations, especially without clear proof, it works to discredit the reporting coming from that area. It can sow doubt, you know, make people question what they're hearing, and it can potentially justify actions against media workers. The Committee to Protect Journalists jumping in, mentioning a smear campaign that highlights this global concern that reporting in these zones is getting riskier. Not just from bombs, but from attempts to delegitimize the journalists themselves. It just makes verifying information so much harder for everyone.
Politically, Netanyahu's office reported a call with U.S. President Donald Trump, thanking him for steadfast support. But we are seeing shifts elsewhere. Germany's Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, is apparently buckling under international criticism. He stopped military equipment exports to Israel, though he did reaffirm their friendship. Still, that suggests even close allies are feeling the pressure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a big deal diplomatically when a close ally like Germany changes its military support posture, even while saying, you know, we're still friends. It shows the scale of the humanitarian crisis and the global outcry are having real, tangible effects, and a tough balancing act for these countries trying to keep alliances strong while also responding to pressure, both domestic and international, about the suffering.
Netanyahu also laid out Israel's stated goals again. No occupation of Gaza, but freeing it, demilitarizing it, establishing overriding security control by the IDF, and putting in a non-Israeli civilian administration. But what really caught my eye was his directive to bring in more foreign journalists into Gaza, which, if that actually happens, would be huge, right? They haven't really been allowed in independently during the war.
Yeah, that directive is really interesting. For months, independent foreign press have basically been shut out. If this changes, it could be, well, a strategic move by Israel to try and manage the narrative by allowing more access, even if it's still controlled. Or maybe it signals a real shift towards more transparency, perhaps looking ahead to a new phase or post-conflict planning. But the real test will be how much unfettered access they get. Can they report freely?
Yeah.
That's something we definitely need to watch closely.
Okay, let's switch gears. From the Middle East to another major flashpoint, Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky has come out very strong this week. He's firmly rejected any idea of ceding territory to Russia. This comes after a suggestion from U.S. President Donald Trump that a peace deal might involve, quote, some exchange of territories. Zelensky was blunt. Ukraine will not give Russia any prize for what it has done, and Ukrainians will not hand over their land to the occupier.
And that rejection is really significant, especially with that planned Trump Putin summit in Alaska coming up. Zelensky was crystal clear about dismissing any talks that don't include Kyiv. He said, and this is quote, any solution without Ukraine is, at the same time, a solution against peace. He called such outcomes dead solutions that will not grab anything and never work. Now, there have been reports, you know, suggesting he privately acknowledged Kyiv might have to accept a sort of de facto recognition of lost land, but his public stance, rock solid. It really highlights that incredibly tricky balance between, you know, the hard realities of war, where concessions might be needed, and the powerful force of national pride and sovereignty.
And it's not just talk. There are active diplomatic moves, too. There was that meeting in England with European and Ukrainian officials, and U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance was there, too, talking about ending the war. Zelensky noted that none of the partners at that meeting doubted the U.S. ability to end the war. That's important, a sign of unity and maybe continued trust in U.S. leadership on this.
Right. And the location choice for the Trump-Putin summit, Alaska, that carries some symbolic weight, too. Some analysts think it could subtly play into Russia's narrative because, you know, Alaska was bought from Russia back in 1867. So having that historical backdrop when you're discussing territorial exchange, well, it could be used to frame the idea in a way that maybe gives it a precedent Russia likes. But despite all this diplomacy, the reality on the ground is still grim. The Kremlin's bigger army keeps up the bombardment, making slow gains. That imbalance really complicates any diplomatic fix.
Okay, our next global flashpoint, Haiti. A three-month state of emergency has been declared in the West, Artemanite, and Center departments. This is a direct response to just escalating insecurity and really severe agricultural and food crises.
The situation in Haiti is just profoundly tragic.
It's a nation battling so many crises at once, all feeding into each other. The Artibonite region, you know, Haiti's rice basket, it's been targeted specifically by this rampant gang violence. Farmers have been forced to abandon fields. It's devastating communities and the country's food supply. And the human toll, it's staggering. Between October 24 and June 25, over 1,000 killed, 200 injured, 620 kidnapped just in those areas, and over 239,000 people displaced in central Haiti, just fleeing the violence. The government's response appointing a new interim police chief working with Kenyan police for that UN mission. It shows how desperate things are. They need major international help just to start calming the chaos. It's a brutal example of what happens when governance just collapses.
All right, let's shift focus now to U.S. political and societal currents. We'll start in Virginia with the governor's race. Republican Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earlseer seems to be running a very defensive campaign. She calls it Operation Defend and Deliver against the Democrat Abigail Spanberger. This race is a big deal. It'll give Virginia its first female governor, and it's a really early key test of voter mood before the 2026 midterms.
Yeah, you can really see the pressure on her campaign. Yeah. That defensive stance was pretty clear in a CNN interview recently. She actually said she felt ambushed about past comments on Trump. But beyond the media stuff, there's a huge money gap that's hard to ignore. Spanberger has raised over $27 million and still has like $15 million in the bank. Earlseer's. Her biggest donor, the Republican Governors Association, gave $500,000. That's way less than Glenn Youngkin got at this stage back in 2021. That financial disadvantage alone is a massive hurdle.
And it's not just about money. There seems to be a real lack of unity on the Republican ticket itself, which is pretty unusual for a race this big. That whole situation with the lieutenant governor candidate, John Reed, Governor Youngkin, actually asked him to step down over social media allegations. And that led to canceling a big statewide rally that was supposed to fire up base. That kind of internal chaos can't be helping her build momentum.
Exactly. And then you add in the, well, surprisingly lukewarm support from President Trump. His focus seems to be on his own stuff, not really hitting the trail hard for state races. Plus, historically, Virginia often elects a governor from the party opposite the first-term president. That's another headwind. But despite all this, Earlseer is defiant, dismissing bad polls, saying don't believe it, and she's openly asking crowds for money. She knows it's an uphill fight. She's acknowledging she needs the cash to win. It really shows a candidate battling both outside pressures and issues within her own party.
Okay, next up, let's look at how President Trump's judicial picks are, maybe quietly, but definitely significantly, reshaping abortion rights for potentially decades. An AP review found about half of his federal judicial nominees in this second term have either expressed anti-abortion views, been linked to anti-abortion groups, or defended abortion restrictions in court.
Yeah, this is a crucial long-game strategy, and arguably one of the most lasting impacts a president can have. These are lifetime appointments. That means they'll be shaping reproductive rights long after Trump leaves office. It doesn't matter if his public stance on abortion being a state issue shifts around. This is how you shape the issue federally without passing new laws. It's less visible day to day, but incredibly powerful legally.
The review shows a clear pattern, right? These nominees have consistently challenged federal abortion care protections, pushed for bans, even co-authored lawsuits using what critics call misinformation. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Absolutely. Let's look at Maria Lanahan, nominated for a district court in Missouri. She helped write a lawsuit challenging the FDA's approval of Mifepristone, the abortion pill, despite decades of safety data. She also backed efforts to defund Planned Parenthood via Medicaid and defended Missouri's abortion ban against religious freedom challenges. Or take Joshua Devine, also a district judge nominee for Missouri. He co-authored that same Mifepristone suit, the one containing misinformation claiming the drug starves the baby to death. He even called himself a zealot for the anti-abortion movement back in college. These aren't just legal opinions. It shows a deep ideological drive to restrict abortion access through the courts.
And that pattern just continues down the list, doesn't it? Solidifying a specific judicial viewpoint, like Whitney Hermendorfer, already confirmed to the Sixth Circuit Court. Her career involved challenging federal abortion care accommodations and Title X rules. John Gard, nominee from Middle District of Florida, defended the state's 15-week ban when he was chief deputy AG. Chad Meredith, nominee for Eastern District of Kentucky, defended that state's ban and things like mandatory ultrasounds.
Right. And you see it with Bill Mercer in Montana, a state lawmaker who consistently backed anti-abortion bills, 20-week bans, waiting periods, parental notification, limits on who can dispense medication abortion. And Jennifer Mascott, nominated to the Third Circuit, has spoken a lot about abortion law, arguing the Roe overturn didn't hurt the court's legitimacy. preferring state control. The White House spokesman, Harrison Fields, says these picks represent his promises and align with the Supreme Court's Dobbs ruling. But Mini Timuraju from Reproductive Freedom for All calls it a larger strategy where Trump has gotten away with distancing himself from abortion while simultaneously appointing anti-abortion extremists. It paints a really clear picture of a deliberate, long-term reshaping of the judiciary. The effects will be felt for decades.
Okay, let's move to another really interesting domestic shift. Democrats seem to be gaining ground in the Villages, Florida, that huge retirement community known for being a solid Republican stronghold. But now there's a growing Democratic presence, apparently energized by Kamala Harris's presidential run.
Yeah, what's really fascinating is the change in social dynamics there. It used to be that left-leaning folks in the Villages kept quiet about their politics. They were afraid of, you know, social fallout, getting kicked out of the golf group, the Mahjong game, pool parties, real pressure to fit in. But these reports suggest they're feeling more confident now, expressing themselves openly. It hints at a shift in the community's social fabric.
And there are concrete examples. The Villages Democratic Club membership nearly doubled since 2020, up to around 1,500 people. They're having golf cart parades with Harris signs. Second gentleman Doug Emhoff visited. And people are saying neighbors approach them when they see a Dem sign saying things like, "We thought we were the only ones." That feeling of relief.
The reasons people give for shifting are pretty revealing, too. They offer a glimpse into wider political changes. You have Howard Underwood, a former Republican, saying flat out, "Trump chased us out of the party, and now the alternative is unthinkable," end quote. And Shelley Newman said something really powerful. "When we moved here, we were more concerned about being Democrat than being Jewish." That really underscores the social pressure they felt. But it's not all smooth sailing. An independent voter, Patricia Coe, reported getting death threats over who she plans to vote for. Chilling.
Eh.
So yeah, it's this really interesting little snapshot of potential national shifts and the, well, sometimes difficult evolution of political expression in really partisan places, even among retirees.
Sticking with President Trump's impact, he seems to have really energized conservative Christians through new religious policies in his first 6 months back in office. Critics, though, argue this erodes church-state separation and leans towards a kind of Christian nationalist bent. What are the key policy areas we're seeing this in?
Yeah, it's a pretty comprehensive approach, playing right into his core base. A big one is cracking down on transgender identity and treatment, an executive order recognizing only male and female sexes, an aim to cut federal support for gender-affirming care for youth. We're already seeing some hospitals stopping those services. Plus, an order to ban transgender athletes from girls and women's sports. That led UPenn to change Leah Thomas's records and even say they'd apologize to female athletes disadvantaged by her competing.
He's also tackled the Johnson Amendment, right? That rule stopping pastors endorsing candidates from the pulpit if they want to keep their tax-exempt status. Now the IRS says pastors can endorse candidates. That's basically carving out an exception Trump promised to destroy way back in 2017.
And Planned Parenthood has been a major focus. Trump signed budget legislation cutting Medicaid payments to them. Now, federal funds can't be used for abortion anyway, but this targets other services like contraception, cancer screenings. He also pardoned anti-abortion activists convicted for blockading clinics. That sends a very direct signal of support for their tactics.
There's also the new White House Faith Office, led by Paula White Cain. She's a well-known charismatic evangelist and early Trump supporter. That puts a key ideological ally right in the middle of faith-based outreach for the administration.
Right. And then there's the new Task Force to Eradicate Anti-Christian Bias. Attorney General Pam Bondi is chairing it. Its job is to find unlawful anti-Christian actions by the last administration and suggest changes. Supporters see it as addressing grievances, but critics question if the country's majority religion really needs special protection like this, seeing it more as a political tool to rally the base.
Even foreign policy appointments tie in. Mike Huckabee confirmed as ambassador to Israel. That reflects strong evangelical support for Israel, even though Huckabee previously supported annexing the West Bank, which is controversial.
And inside the government itself, the Office of Personnel Management put out a memo. It says federal employees can talk about their religion, display religious items, encourage prayer, as long as it's not harassing. Critics worry this could create hostile work environments and further blur that line between church and state in federal workplaces.
And even though there aren't new Supreme Court picks this term, his first term appointees, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Barrett, they keep delivering wins for Christian conservatives. Recent rulings allowed parents to pull kids from lessons with LGBTQ plus storybooks, upheld Tennessee's gender-affirming care ban, blocked Medicaid going to Planned Parenthood. The impact is ongoing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And finally, there is this broad culture war being waged against institutions often seen as liberal universities, museums, public broadcasting, cutting funding, demanding changes at places like the Smithsonian, Library of Congress, pushing back hard against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in government and corporations. Critics like Reverend Shannon Fleck argue these policies serve manipulators of Christianity seeking power, not really lifting up the vulnerable. So, yeah, it's a really wide-ranging effort to align federal policy and cultural institutions with a very specific conservative Christian viewpoint.
Okay, let's transition now. We're moving into health, wellness, and public safety. First, let's talk about summer sniffles. Colds, flu, COVID-19, what's going on?
Well, it might seem odd for summer, but while flu and RSV are pretty low, COVID-19 is actually ticking up again. Mid-Atlantic, Southeast, Southern states, West Coast, seeing increases. And this really helps bust that old myth that cold weather causes colds. It's not the temperature itself. It's more about behavior. When it's scorching hot, what do? We all head indoors into the air conditioning. And that means more time in enclosed spaces with recirculated air where germs just spread more easily. It's about proximity, really.
So it's the AC bringing us all together, not the cold making us sick. Got it. And besides the usual suspects, other things going around this time of year include hand, foot, and mouth disease and norovirus, the lovely stomach flu.
Yeah, and the prevention advice. It's the same good advice year-round. Get outside when you can, wash your hands often, and, well, maybe wear a mask in crowded indoor spots if you're worried, and definitely stay home if you're sick. Simple stuff, but really effective no matter the season or the virus.
Okay, moving to brain health. Some really positive news here about aging sharper. Initial results from a big U.S. study suggest older folks, 60s, 70s, can actually slow down age-related cognitive decline through lifestyle changes.
And what's really great here is how achievable it sounds. The study makes it clear it's not too late to start, and you don't need to become some kind of extreme athlete or give up everything you enjoy, like ice cream. They found that by consistently exercising body and brain and eating healthier, people scored on brain tests like they were a year or two younger. That's pretty significant. Because these habits fight things like high blood pressure, cholesterol, heart disease, diabetes, all known risk factors for dementia, it shows a proactive approach can really make a difference.
So what are the practical tips? What can someone actually do if they want to try this?
Well, the advice is pretty straightforward. For physical activity, aim for moderate intensity. You know, raises your heart rate, you pant a bit, but you can still talk. Start slow if you need to. Even 10 minutes is good. And pick something you actually like doing so you'll stick with it. For brain exercise, puzzles, book clubs, learning an instrument, a new language, things that challenge your mind. One participant, Phyllis Jones, 66, she loves blueberry spinach smoothies now and uses VR for exercise. So it'd be varied. Researchers are still analyzing brain scans and blood tests, looking for things like maybe reduced Alzheimer's protein buildup. The challenge, of course, is keeping up the new habits. But these early results are really hopeful for anyone worried about their brain health as they age.
Next up, mindful eating. Do you tend to wolf down your meals in under 20 minutes? Might want to slow down?
Yeah, this is a really important connection between how we eat and our body's signals. Often overlooked, that 20-minute rule. It's based on physiology. It takes about 20 minutes for your stomach to send the I'm full message to your brain via hormones. If you eat super fast, you basically outrun those signals. You end up eating more than you need before your brain even registers you're satisfied. And that can lead to problems. Swallowing air causes bloating and digestion. Poor digestion means you absorb fewer nutrients. Food can even get stuck. And there's a very clear link to a higher risk of obesity.
Okay, so how do we actually practice this, slowing down in our busy lives?
There are some good practical tips. One of the best. Reduce distractions. Turn off the TV, put the phone away, just focus on eating. That mindfulness alone can help you enjoy the food more and eat less naturally. You could also try little behavioral tricks. Use your non-dominant hand to eat. Try chopsticks if you usually use a fork. Take deliberate sips of water between bites. And simply chew your food more. It sounds basic, but it works. Interestingly, ultra-processed foods, fast foods, they're often softer, easier to eat quickly, makes mindfulness harder. There was this anecdote about a patient who, when asked to eat potato chips slowly, said they just tasted like claggy chemicals. Not enjoyable anymore. It shows how slowing down changes everything.
All right, let's shift to global health threats. We're seeing a pretty big chikungunya outbreak, especially in southern China. That's a mosquito-borne disease, and its spread is worrying.
It really is. This looks like China's largest documented outbreak of chikungunya. Over 7,000 cases, 90 deaths just in Foshan. Globally, around 240,000 cases reported across 16 countries. Brazil, Bolivia, Argentina, Peru have the highest numbers. The main symptoms are fever and really bad joint pain, which can sometimes last for months. Mosquitoes spread it. There's no specific cure for the virus itself, but vaccines do exist for people traveling to risky areas. In China, the fact that the population didn't have much prior immunity probably helped it spread so fast.
And the control measures China's putting in place sound pretty intense, distributing mosquito nets, spraying insecticides, but also fining people up to $1,400 for having stagnant water outside.
Yeah.
And even threatening to cut off electricity.
Yeah, it shows how seriously they're taking it. But crucially, this outbreak is tied to bigger environmental changes. Climate change and urban expansion. Experts point to unusual heavy rains and high temperatures this year, creating perfect mosquito breeding grounds. This really highlights a worrying global trend. More outbreaks of mosquito-borne diseases like chikungunya, dengue, Zika, since around 2000. It's a clear example of how our warming planet isn't just bringing new health threats, but making existing ones worse. Requires constant vigilance.
And now a really sobering story about polio. That stubborn comeback, the world was so close to getting rid of it, but it's still hanging on in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's a story of, well, missteps, system failures, and deep mistrust.
It's genuinely heartbreaking because, yeah, we were on the verge of this incredible public health victory. But this AP investigation, internal documents, they reveal huge systemic problems, like managers telling workers to fake records, mark kids as immunized when they weren't, just because of pressure to hit targets. That completely undermines the data. And there are issues with the oral vaccine itself. In rare cases, it can actually cause outbreaks. Mutated viruses from the vaccine are responsible for most cases outside Afghanistan and Pakistan now. That's a massive complication.
And the problems go deeper, right? Reports of mismanagement, unqualified people giving drops, teams not being sent out, concerns about keeping the vaccine cold just dismissed.
Exactly. And beyond those system issues, you have huge local challenges. Cultural, religious authorities sometimes advising against vaccination, mistrust, and tragically, hundreds of polio workers and their security teams have been killed because they're seen as part of this Western-led effort. It makes doing the work incredibly dangerous. All this breeds deep mistrust in communities. People are focused on immediate needs, food, water, not necessarily a vaccine. There are these unfounded fears, the vaccine sterilizes kids, causes disability, anger that polio gets all this focus when other diseases like measles, TB are also killing people.
And that lingering damage from the 2011 CIA fake hepatitis campaign in Pakistan, searching for bin Laden, that destroyed trust in all vaccination efforts there. Plus, parents reportedly getting threats if they refuse vaccination. It creates an impossible situation for families.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Jamal Ahmed, WHO's polio director, he defends the progress, calls the oral vaccine a core pillar. But big critics like Dr. Zulfikar Bhutta, Dr. Tom Frieden, they're calling for a major course correction, an independent inquiry into past failures. They point to a 2016 miscalculation that led to outbreaks paralyzing over 3,000 kids. So there's this urgent need to rethink the strategy, especially with the campaign costing $1 billion a year and worries about funding with the U.S. pulling back from WHO, cutting foreign aid. The real risk, if we don't eradicate it, polio could spread globally again.
Okay, shifting focus back to the U.S. public health. New York City is dealing with a Legionnaire's disease outbreak in central Harlem. Reports say 3 deaths, over 60 people sick since late July.
Yeah, that's definitely a serious concern, especially in a dense city like New York. They've linked it to cooling towers. Those big units on buildings that use water and fans for cooling. Legionella bacteria can grow in them. People usually get sick by breathing in tiny water droplets, aerosols, from contaminated water. Not just cooling towers. Could be hospital water systems, ice machines, even water births sometimes. Importantly, though, you can't catch it from another person. It's not contagious like the flu.
Symptoms sound flu-like. Cough, fever, headache, muscle aches, shortness of breath. Develops 2 days to 2 weeks after exposure. What about treatment? How serious is it?
Quick diagnosis and antibiotics are key. If you don't treat it, Legionnaires can get bad fast. Respiratory failure, multi-organ failure, it can be fatal. So prevention is crucial. Building managers need strict cleaning protocols for cooling towers, proper chlorine in pools, and individuals can do things too. Drain garden hoses, clean faucet filters, flush your hot water heater twice a year, helps prevent bacteria buildup. Really shows how important both strong public health rules and just individual awareness are in stopping these outbreaks.
Now, turning to medical device safety, the FDA has flagged issues with 2 heart devices made by Boston Scientific. They've been linked to a worrying number of injuries, even deaths.
This is a big deal for patient safety and trust in medical tech. The FDA warning is aimed at doctors and patients. One device, a type of wire they sold from 2002 to 2021, it's not available anymore, has been linked to 386 serious injuries and 16 deaths. 10 of those deaths were because the device itself failed. 4 others happened during surgery trying to remove the faulty device. That's awful. The other device, the Watchman system that's used to prevent blood clots, has seen 120 serious injuries and 17 deaths, though the company says those aren't due to design or manufacturing problems.
Boston Scientific put out a statement saying they're working to prevent incidents. They hired a new chief food safety officer, but their spokespeople wouldn't do interviews on this.
Yeah, and this leaves patients in a really tough spot if they need these devices replaced, because the removal surgery itself carries risks. And it's definitely got financial implications for Boston Scientific. Heart devices are a big part of their business. The FDA warning is meant to give doctors and patients the info to weigh the risks, but it really highlights that ongoing challenge. How do you ensure safety after complex devices are approved and out in the world?
And sticking with safety, this time food safety. That Boar's Head deli meat plant in Jarrett, Virginia. It was linked to that deadly listeria outbreak last year. 10 deaths, dozens sick. It plans to reopen now the USDA lifted its suspension. But Lee, reports suggest there are still sanitation problems at other Boar's Head plants.
This is deeply concerning. It raises serious questions about whether the company really fixed the underlying issues. Okay, so the Jarrett plant got the green light. But recent inspections, Jan to July, at other Boar's Head plants, Arkansas, Indiana, Petersburg, Virginia, found similar sanitation problems. Parking visible meat residue on equipment, blocked drains, condensation dripping, overflowing trash, staff hygiene issues. These are the exact kinds of basic sanitation failures that contributed to the deadly outbreak in the first place.
Right. Finding these things after a deadly outbreak, it makes you question the company's promises and the oversight. Sandra Eskin from Stop HE Foodborne Illness and Rep Rosa DeLauro called the findings appalling. They pointed to a pattern of negligence, a food safety culture problem. So what does this pattern, even after people died, suggest about food safety oversight, and what should consumers take away?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
This pattern suggests that maybe the regulatory system, even with its efforts, isn't always enough to force deep cultural change in a company if they seem to prioritize production over rigorous safety. For consumers, especially vulnerable folks, older people, pregnant women, immunocompromised, it's a stark warning. Barbara Kalsik at George Washington University advised consumers need to be aware that there are issues at this organization that still are not completely under control, apparently. It signals the previous outbreak might not have led to the systemic fix promised, which puts the burden of caution back on the consumer, especially with risky foods like deli meat.
Okay, let's move to major incidents and disasters. A shooting at the CDC headquarters in Atlanta tragically highlights the deadly potential of vaccine misinformation. A police officer was killed. The shooter, Patrick Joseph White, apparently blamed the COVID-19 vaccine for his depression and suicidal thoughts.
It's just a horrifying example of how deeply misinformation can take root and lead to violence. White, 30 years old, armed with 5 guns, tried to get into the CDC, then drove across the street to a pharmacy and opened fire. It's unclear if he died by suicide or from police fire, but his neighbor confirmed he truly believed vaccines hurt him and were hurting other people. Though the neighbor never expected violence, it just shows how conspiracy theories can warp reality for someone, making them blame something external for their pain, sometimes with devastating consequences.
The union representing CDC staff, AFGE Local 2883, they're demanding leaders at CDC and HHS take a clear and unequivocal stance in condemning vaccine disinformation. They want to prevent more violence against scientists. They even mentioned a group of former CDC employees blaming HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for villainization of the workforce.
And the impact on the staff there, huge. Beyond the physical danger, thousands locked down during the shooting, including over 90 kids at the CDC's own school. The union's asking not to force people back to work right away amidst bullet holes, calling for better security. It shows the deep trauma, the real danger misinformation creates, not just bad health choices, but actual physical threats to public health workers. A stark reminder of the real-world cost of a poisoned information environment.
Switching to a bizarre, tragic incident, an MRI machine accident in New York. A 61-year-old man died after being pulled into the machine by a large chain necklace he was wearing.
This just underscores the hidden power, the danger of those magnets. MRI magnets are unbelievably strong. Experts say they can literally fling a wheelchair across the room if it has metal parts. This awful incident is a critical reminder. Absolutely all metal objects must be removed before going near an MRI. Jewelry, piercings, implants, even things that seem small can become dangerous projectiles. It shows why following safety protocols in these high-tech places isn't just a suggestion, it's literally life or death.
In Puerto Rico, a tourist from New York, Kevin Mayers, 25, was shot and killed early Sunday in La Perla, Old San Juan. He was there for a Bad Bunny concert. Tragically, just an innocent bystander caught in an argument. Two others were hurt.
Yeah, and this happened at a spot called Refuge for Mistreated Men, around 4:13 a.m., which is notable because that violates local rules about when bars have to stop selling alcohol. La Perla has this difficult history, known for drug trafficking, struggling to shake off a violent reputation. This wasn't the first time a tourist was killed there recently. Another incident in 2024 involved a drug deal gone wrong and someone taking photos when warned not to. It's a sad reminder that even as tourism grows, some areas still grapple with crime and maybe lack of enforcement, creating risks for visitors who might not be aware.
Moving to extreme weather, flash floods forced the cancellation of the last day of the Wisconsin State Fair, up to 14 inches of rain near Milwaukee, power outages for 18,000, cars abandoned, playgrounds underwater. Firefighters got over 600 calls, gas leaks, flooded basements, water rescues.
And at the same time, strong storms hit Nebraska. Killed one person when a tree fell on a car, seriously injured another in a state park. And get this, the storms displaced 387 inmates at the state penitentiary because housing units were damaged. The National Weather Service had flood warnings out for parts of six Midwest states, Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, predicting more heavy rain, hail, damaging winds, even isolated tornadoes. It just shows how widespread these severe weather events are now, hitting everything from fairs to prisons.
In Hawaii, a 75-foot passenger boat, the Discovery, ran aground off Honolulu in high surf. The operator said two big waves hit the stern, messed up their course, then they lost power after hitting the ground. No mechanical failure found.
Thankfully, they acted fast to prevent pollution.
Right.
Remove fuel, oil, batteries right away. A surfing filmmaker who saw it happen said the boat tried to beat this wave but didn't have enough power, lost steering and grounded. It's just a powerful reminder of nature's force, even for big boats, and how quickly things can change on the water. Need to adapt fast.
And a really unusual encounter in New Hampshire. A whale surfaced right under a 23-foot fishing boat, capsized it, threw two fishermen into the water.
Wow. Luckily, both fishermen were rescued by two young brothers nearby. Everyone was safe. And the whale seemed okay, too, just swam off. Experts think it was probably lunge feeding, you know, where they come up fast with their mouths open to gulp fish. Highly likely that the whale just didn't even see the boat there while it was focused on feeding. A startling but thankfully harmless reminder of the wildlife sharing the ocean with us.
Okay, let's move into our final segment, culture, curiosities, and unpacking misinformation. First up, this story about Frederick Richard, the gymnast, trying to make men's gymnastics uniforms.
Well, cooler.
Yeah, this is a pretty bold move in a sport known for being, let's say, traditional in its look. Richard thinks the standard stirrup pants are just not cool and actually turn kids off the sport. So he designed his own alternative. Zebra-patterned leggings with shorts over them, debuted them at Nationals. He got deductions for it, right? 0.3 points for not wearing the traditional pants. But he says it was 1,000% worth it. He's doing it for the young boys watching, hoping they think, hey, that looks cool, I want to do that. He's directly trying to fight the decline in popularity of men's gymnastics in the U.S. compared to places like China and Japan, where it's huge.
It definitely sparks debate. Some critics are like, if he wants to look like a basketball player, go play basketball. Pretty dismissive. But others, like his Olympic teammate, Steven Nitoroshik, agree there should be more flexibility with uniforms, especially if it helps the sport grow. Richard seems committed, says he'll keep pushing it, wear the new look for 10 years if he has to, make it a trend. It's this interesting mix of sport, style, and trying to influence culture. Shows how even small changes can start big conversations.
Next, a moment of controversy in football. Mohamed Salah questioning UEFA's farewell message for a former Palestine player, Suleiman Obaid.
This is really sensitive, deeply tied into the conflict. Obaid was described as one of the brightest stars of Palestinian football. He was reportedly shot and killed by Israeli forces while waiting for aid in Gaza. Played 24 times for Palestine, scored over 100 goals locally. A big figure. UEFA President Alexander Heffern expressed sadness, called Obaid proof that joy, skill, and pride can flourish despite suffering, acknowledging his death.
But there are conflicting reports here, which makes it complicated. The Israeli military spokesman replied to Salah saying they have no records of any incidents involving Suleiman al-Obaid, asking for more details. That's directly opposite the Palestinian FA's claim that Obaid's death brings the total Palestinian athletes and officials killed to 662 since the conflict started.
Right. And this specific death happens against the backdrop of wider reports. The UN Human Rights Office just last month said about 1,400 Palestinians were killed seeking aid since May, almost all by Israeli fire. So this case, and Saleh bringing it up so publicly, it highlights the human cost, obviously, but also the ongoing fight over casualty numbers, over the narrative itself, makes getting clear facts incredibly hard, shows how even one death becomes a point of major international argument.
Okay, on a lighter note, the box office. Horror film Weapons from director Zach Kriger had a big opening weekend, topped the charts with $42.5 million domestic, $70 million worldwide.
Yeah, that's a nice win for Warner Bros. Their seventh number one opening this year, and the sixth film in a row to open over $40 million here. August can be a good month for edgier movies after the big summer blockbusters fade. Weapons hit that sweet spot. It's described as mixing horror, paranoia, existential humor, much like Kriger's last hit, Barbarian. That genre blend clearly works.
And good marketing help too, right? Viral buzz, strong social media word of mouth for both Weapons and Freakier Friday, which came in second.
Definitely. It's looking like a strong comeback year for Warner Bros. Overall, Jurassic World Rebirth is nearing $800 million globally. This success, especially for a horror film that mixes things up, shows there's still a big appetite for unique stories and smart marketing, particularly in horror, which really thrives on buzz.
Here's a story that might inspire you to explore your own backyard. A woman's quest to visit every single museum in New York City. Jane August started in 2021, visiting and making short video logs of each one.
That's incredibly ambitious. She's hit 136 so far, 64 to go, wants to finish before she turns 30. What started personal became a public project. She has over 40,000 followers now, inspiring others. She says it's given her this amazing appreciation for the city's depth, especially the smaller museums, the ones outside Manhattan people often miss.
And she had some great recommendations. Poster House First in the U.S. for just posters, Free Fridays, Tenement Museum, Museum of the Moving Image, but also unique Brooklyn spots.
Yeah.
The Seltzer Museum, the Sign Museum, the Red Hook Pinball Museum. Shows the amazing variety.
Yeah, and she really pushes people to take the free ferry to Staten Island for hidden gems like the Newhouse Center of Contemporary Art, the Alice Austin House, important for LGBTQ plus history, the Jacques Marché Museum of Tibetan Art. Really unique stuff. Her practical advice: use library passes, hit free days times, go during slow weekdays. And her videos, they've apparently given a huge bump in attendance and press to smaller museums. Shows the real impact one person's passion can have. A great example of how even a famous city has endless discoveries, if you look.
In Brooklyn, Black church choirs are fighting to keep their tradition alive despite falling attendance and gentrification. This music was the bedrock of early Black churches, a source of unity, uplift for enslaved ancestors.
It's a testament to their resilience, but the numbers show the challenge. Black Protestant church attendance dropped sharply from 61% to 46% monthly between 2019 and 2023. Fastest decline among major U.S. groups, and choir sizes reflect that. Concord Baptist once had 100 voices, now just 30. That impacts the sound, the ministry.
What's driving this decline besides just general church attendance trends?
It's a mix of things. The pandemic definitely sped it up. People got used to Zoom, slower return to in-person. There's a generational shift. Younger folks often don't see church as central as older generations did. The youngest choir member at Concord noted only a fewer age attend. Plus, cuts to music education in NYC schools since the 70s fiscal crisis. That means fewer younger people have basic music skills needed for choirs. And then gentrification. Neighborhoods like Crown Heights, Bed-Stuy, changing demographics impact the congregations directly. But despite all that, these choirs remain vital communities within the churches. Singing is seen as ministry. The fight to keep places like St. Teresa of Avila, First U.S. Church, with Mass and Creole open, that's about preserving living history, identity.
Moving south now, to the Gullah Geechee elders preserving sacred songs from enslaved ancestors in the South Carolina Sea Islands.
This is such a crucial cultural preservation effort. Keeping a unique heritage alive, you have this group of singers, mostly in their 70s and 80s, like Minnie Gracie Gadsden, dedicating themselves to these songs. They're sung in Gullah Creole language with deep West African roots, described as a language of survival, resilience, tenacity. Not just music. They still ring out in the few remaining wooden praise houses, like Coffin Point. Places where enslaved people could worship away from owners, practice African traditions, do ring shouts, that powerful counterclockwise dance.
And many songs had coded meanings, right? Helping people survive slavery. Musicologist Eric Crawford traced them back to the first book of African American spirituals. He says these singers today, they're as close as we can get to how the enslaved actually sang them.
That authenticity is incredible. And the Voices of Gullah Group, they've toured extensively U.S., Belize, Mexico, sharing this culture, this history embedded in the music, as Elder Emery Campbell put it. If we don't know who we are, we're lost. And Marlena Smalls added, there's power in this place still. It's vital work, not just saving songs, but maintaining identity, heritage, a sense of place in a changing world.
Okay, now for some oddities and environmental messages. First, this quirky tradition, German elves cycling to Santa Claus Village in Finland.
This is just charming, isn't it? A bit of holiday spirit meets modern eccentricity. It's part of this tradition where German post office volunteers answer thousands of letters sent to the St. Nicholas post office each year, each reply with a special stamp. This year, St. Nicholas himself even gave the cyclists his own wish list for Santa, a lovely cross-cultural holiday journey.
Next, something less charming. Ground squirrels apparently taking over Minot, North Dakota. Richardson's ground squirrels, native there, burrowing everywhere, numbers exploding over the last couple decades.
Yeah, this sounds less like a nuisance, more like an invasion. Tens of thousands, possibly more squirrels than people in Minot. They're hard to control. Breed fast 6 babies a year. And in cities, they lack natural predators. They've been on the prairie forever, so getting rid of them is basically impossible. The impact. Real damage to driveways, sidewalks, lawns, tripping hazards, fleas carrying disease. One even got into someone's apartment. Shows how pervasive they are.
So what are they doing about this furry swarm?
Trying lots of things. Pest control uses snares, carbon monoxide, air rifles. The nearby Air Force base trapped over 800 DAC rats, as they call them. But here's the twist. Some people think they're adorable, so they sabotage traps, confront pest control for hurting wildlife, even though officials call them vermin and a pest and dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's that weird conflict between a real nuisance and public sentiment about animals.
Now, this is cool. Giant trolls made entirely from trash carrying an environmental message. Danish recycle artist Thomas Dambo creates these amazing sculptures.
This is such a creative way to talk about sustainability. His Troll Save the Humans installation is at Filoli in California, part of a global show seen by millions. The idea is that trolls are ancient. They've seen humans mess up the planet. These young trolls think they can teach us to protect it. Each troll teaches something, building birdhouses from scraps, planting flowers, making jewelry from garbage.
Dambo calls his work huge proof of concept of why we should not throw things out, but why we should recycle it. It's art making a real point.
Exactly. Turning waste into wonder, raising awareness, maybe inspiring action. Really powerful.
Lastly, a sad end for a strange tourist attraction in Israel. A group of Nile crocodiles at a West Bank settlement is being euthanized. Repeated escapes, reports of inhumane treatment.
Yeah, this is a complicated one. They were brought to Petzel initially for tourism, then bought by someone wanting to sell their skin. But then in 2012, Israel classified reptiles as protected. Banned selling them as meat or goods, left their fate unclear.
So why euthanasia now?
Kogat, the Israeli defense body involved, cited two reasons. The threat to residents from escapes and animal abuse. Poor conditions, not enough food, even cannibalism reported. There were worries years ago about one reaching the Jordan River, causing an international incident. They apparently spent a lot trying to refence the farm before deciding on euthanasia as the only humane option left. A sad end to an unusual venture, highlighting the complexities of managing exotic animals, especially in that region.
All right, let's wrap up with AP fact checks, crucial for navigating all the information and misinformation out there. First, debunking a false claim about George Floyd's autopsy.
Right. This claim keeps popping up online. A new 2023 autopsy report supposedly shows Floyd died of an overdose, not police actions. Totally false. The page shared is from the original 20-page report released June 3, 2020. Nothing has changed.
And while that page does mention fentanyl and meth and says no life-threatening injuries, that's cherry-picking. The full report clearly concludes homicide due to cardiopulmonary arrest from law enforcement's subdual, restraint, and neck compression.
Exactly. And experts at Chauvin's trial confirmed he didn't die of an overdose. Underlying conditions, drug use made him more vulnerable, yes, but didn't change the cause of death being homicide. And lack of visible injury doesn't rule out asphyxia. It's a classic misinformation tactic. Twist a fragment of fact to push a false narrative.
Next, a photo of Trump's ear with no damage, being shared as proof he wasn't hurt in the assassination attempt.
Quick debunk on this one. The photo is old, from September 2022. The assassination attempt, where Trump and two others were wounded and one person died, was Saturday, August 9, 2025. They're just using an old picture falsely. common tactic to sow doubt quickly after a big event.
How about this persistent conspiracy? The Titanic didn't sink. It was secretly switched with its sister ship, the Olympic.
Oh, this one just won't die. It's decades old, completely unfounded. Maritime historians say it's impossible. The evidence is overwhelming. Each ship had unique ID numbers. Olympic 400, Titanic 401, stamped on everything, including wood panels. Artifacts from Titanic clearly show 401. Olympic items show 400.
And just the logistics, switching all that paneling, which took months to install, in just a few days, it's absurd.
Completely absurd. Plus, British authorities surveyed both ships meticulously down to the last rivet. And the switch would have had to happen in the very public Harland and Wolff shipyard in Belfast, where people took photos constantly. No way. It just crumbles under any scrutiny.
Another one causing confusion. A peel-produced coating. Claims it's a chemical from Bill Gates and WEF. Can't be washed off. Unsafe. They share a safety data sheet as proof.
There's pure confusion. Probably deliberate.
Yeah.
The safety data sheet they show. It's for a hard surface cleaner, also named Apeel, made by a UK company. Totally unrelated to Apeel Science's produce coating. The real Apeel product, Edapeel, uses plant oils found naturally in fruits and veggies. Creates an edible coating to keep moisture in, slow oxidation.
Yeah.
The FDA calls it generally recognized as safe, GRAS. It's even in things like infant formula. It's just two companies with similar names. Highlights why you need to check sources carefully before believing scary viral claims, especially ones linking everyday things to big conspiracies.
And a fake CNN banner image showing synagogue hostage taker identified as peaceful Muslim.
Totally fake. Manipulated image. It started on the Babylon Bee, a satirical website, back in March 2021. The real CNN banner from the event in Mimics, the Boulder supermarket shooting, read, Colorado shooting suspect booked into jail today. CNN confirmed it was fake, wrong font. Newer versions even crop out the date to hide its origin. Just crude disinformation.
And one last one. A false quote attributed to Hillary Clinton saying the average Democrat voter is just plain stupid, easy to manipulate.
Completely false. Debunked many times. It was claimed to be from a 2004 book by Dick Morris. Morris himself categorically denied it was in the book. The image with the fake quote popped up on Tumblr in 2015, explicitly asking people to share it and vote for Trump, shows the political motivation. Always question inflammatory quotes without solid sources. So after all that, what's the takeaway for you? Today's deep dive into the AP reports for August 11th, 2025. It really paints this incredibly complex picture of our world, doesn't it? You see everything from these deeply personal battles with misinformation impacting safety to huge geopolitical shifts and even these quiet cultural efforts to hold on to heritage or change norms.
Exactly. We've kind of journeyed through tragedy and resilience, science and anxiety, and that constant struggle to tell fact from fiction in this flood of information. Our goal is always to give you that context, right? Help you see beyond the headline, really get the why behind these stories, not just the what, but the connections, the implications.
Which raises a really important question for all of us, I think. In this age of too much information, but maybe not enough clarity, how do we as people trying to stay informed, how do we not just understand these complex things, but also maybe contribute to a better, more informed conversation?
Yeah. What stuck with you today, maybe it was that link between climate change and health, or how politics is shifting in subtle ways locally. As you go about your day, maybe think about how you engage with these things. Not just consuming news, but actively participating in understanding the world, maybe even shaping it a little. We hope this deep dive gave you a good starting point.